This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Progressive helps you compare direct auto rates from a variety of companies so you can find a great one, even if it's not with them. Quote today at progressive.com to find a rate that works with your budget. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, November 22nd, 2016, President Obama awards the Presidential Medal of Freedom to 21 Americans, among them a woman by the name of Grace Hopper. Hopper, a mathematician and physicist, joined the Navy in 1943, where she worked as a programmer and coder on lots of the earliest efforts towards electronic computing. She would come to be known as the Queen of Code, and that is what we're talking about today, Grace Hopper's contributions to computing, her place in history alongside a lot of other women whose names we may not know as well. So, you know, we hooked it to 2016, but really we're talking about the mid-40s into the early 50s here. And here to discuss, as always, is Nicole Hemmer of Columbia. Hello, Nikki.
Hi, Jody.
And our guest is Mar Hicks, historian of technology and the author of the book Programmed Inequality, an associate professor of history at Illinois Tech University. Mar, thank you for joining us here.
Thanks for having me.
So I kind of want to just get a sense of Grace Hopper's, how well-known she is. I mean, she strikes me as kind of like right on the cusp of like maybe the most well-known hidden figure or something. But, you know, she did win a Presidential Medal of Freedom. There have been some books. She shows up in movies from time to time. But like, give us that context about how much she is hidden history and how much she is lionized as the Queen of Code.
Sure. Well, I think it's important when we use the term hidden figure to really make clear that that is a term that applies to Black women, Black women in computing. And so I wouldn't call Grace Hopper a hidden figure. I would say that in some ways we can talk about her history being hidden a little bit because she was a woman in a male-dominated field. But in other respects, you know, she's incredibly famous. She's almost synonymous with women in computing history at this point. So is she hidden at this point? I don't think so. And she had a hand in sort of unhiding herself even before she passed on and her, you know, legacy kind of became the stuff of myth in the history of computing.
It is always fascinating when a single person gets plucked from a group and becomes emblematic of that group or becomes the one name that everyone knows. And it's interesting to think about the balance between how much that is historians and journalists choosing that person and how much it is that person choosing themselves.
Yeah, exactly. So much of it is what journalists say and what historians say after the fact. But there is also a role to be played by the people themselves who are, you know, accomplishing things and how they put their accomplishments out there and talk about themselves and seek the public spotlight or not. Now, Grace Hopper really sought that public spotlight. And she was, you know, what we might call today, she was a really great science communicator. She was an evangelist for the importance of computing. She thought that computers were going to really change everything and that everybody should know about them. And so she went around, you know, going on TV. She was on David Letterman at one point in her life. And she went around to all sorts of different businesses and schools and universities talking about computing and really inserting herself into the history as an important figure in the history of computing.
I want to come back to that version of her as a communicator, and that David Letterman interview is really fantastic. People should go check it out. But you know, on this question of what her actual contributions were, I think Nikki's point is really well taken about, especially I think with technology and invention, you know, we tend to lionize like the inventor, when in fact, my sense is, you know much better than I do, Mar, but my sense is this is much more collaborative. It happens much more in fits and starts. So kind of where do you start to paint a picture of what she actually did contribute given that context of the way that technology actually advances?
Yeah, that's such a good point that you make about the sort of idea of the lone genius or the singular inventor usually not being the way things go. Grace Hopper did a lot of really important things in her career. I think maybe the one that we would pluck out as the most important and the sort of the one that's most under her control is the invention of the first compiler. So a compiler is something that allows machine code to be interpreted into a higher level computing language, or rather allows a higher level computing language to be interpreted into machine code. So you can write something, whether it's COBOL or Fortran or some sort of higher level computing language that's easier for people to read and write and understand. Instead of writing in machine code, you can write it in this programming language, and then a compiler will essentially compile it, interpret it for the machine. So that was one really, really important thing that she developed first. And she also was doing a lot of things like this to try to make computers more usable. So that's kind of the theme of her career. How do we make computers more useful and more usable to everyday people?
Which I guess is of a piece with this idea of her as a great communicator, right?
Yeah, it really is.
I'm really curious about the role of the military in all of this, because the kind of computing history that I know has to do with like ARPANET, which was developed by the military that would eventually become the internet. So it is a story where the military plays a big role in computing history. So what about her role as a member of the military as well as one of these coders?
Yeah, the military is all over the history of computing. I mean, computers, in a pretty, you know, direct sense, they were developed as weapons of war. And the computer that she got her start on, that she's most famous for initially working on, is the Mark I, which was a computer that was based at Harvard, but it was in the service of the U.S. military during World War II. That's really why that computer got the money to be finished as a project. And so she was working on ballistics trajectories and other types of calculations for the conduct of war while she was programming the Mark I. But I think the most important thing about the Mark I really was not what it produced for the military in the sense of, you know, charts or tables or information that it spat out. What was really important was the programmers that it trained, not just Hopper, but many other people who got their start in programming on the Mark I and then went on to do other things, went on to become some of the field's earliest computer experts. So yeah, she's very much a product of military computing and military history.
Does gender intersect with that at all? I mean, we tend to think of the military as a pretty male space. And so does the fact that a lot of this technological innovation was happening through the military affect the way in which inventions and early computing was either male or not male dominated space?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think also the specific time period in military history matters as well. So, you know, she comes into it not during peacetime, but during World War II, when it's an all hands on deck situation. And you see both in the United States and in the UK that tons and tons of women are doing stuff for the war effort that maybe they wouldn't have done in peacetime because a lot of men are at the front. Now, I do have to point out that that's not exactly the case for computing, because prior to World War II, computing, before it was electronic, it was done more by people and electric machines, and it was already a feminized field. So women would have been doing that either way, but they do get a lot more opportunities to work with cutting-edge equipment during the war because there is a massive war on.
I find the role of women in this so interesting, and the role of the military and universities, because I think the received story we have about tech is that it's private, it's Silicon Valley, and it's almost entirely dominated by white men. And so recovering this earlier history and even just reading about like how some of these early women coders, they come not even from a science background, but from a philosophy background, because understanding logic was so important to writing some of this early code. I think it's so helpful to root it in this particular history because it's so different from the stories we tell today.
Yeah, that's a really good point. This idea that somehow computing is an artifact of private companies and the innovation of people working in the private sector, that's a relatively new story. And it's something that we really only see happening after the advent of the personal computer. But for a long time, this history is very much reliant on military investment. And it's still, I mean, to this day, the history of computing, the present of computing, is reliant on government and military investment for sure.
Let's come back to Grace Hopper a little bit. And I'm curious if, you know, this question of her being such a good communicator, you know, you watch her speak, she's just a great storyteller. She's a great sort of personality that sort of pops off the screen. Is it just as simple as that? You know, she just knows how to tell a good story? Or did she also kind of feel like she needed to be out there proselytizing?
I think that she had a knack for it, but you're right. She very much felt like this was something she had to do. She was a good performer who really tried to be a good performer. And one of the interesting things about Grace Hopper is that when you go into her history and you look at the other women in computing who were working around her and with her, they didn't have this same impression that the public did. You know, she seems like a very affable, a very cute kind of, you know, oh, look, the little old lady who's telling us about computing on the TV or wherever. But a lot of the women who worked with her, they actually said that she took credit for a lot of their accomplishments. And so there's definitely a difference between the public Grace and the more private Grace, or the Grace who worked with folks when she wasn't on screen or on show proselytizing.
I'm really struck by the way her image feeds into that, because both of you have mentioned this David Letterman appearance that she makes in 1986 after she retires from the Navy. And it really is playing off of the idea that she is this very petite, very elderly woman at the time. She's 79 years old, about to turn 80. And it's that disconnect and her sort of buoyancy that I think catapults her into the public consciousness more, because it subverts what people expect. And she knows to play that up. I mean, she has her little handbag next to her, like pulling out little props as she's doing this interview. She's somebody who very much understood the medium she was in and could play to the cameras in this way that I was really surprised by. And I have to say, I found her incredibly charismatic.
Yeah, I mean, I think she was amazingly charismatic. And even before, you know, she was as old as she was in that Letterman interview, she was always very diminutive. You know, she, I think she got in trouble with enlisting in the military. She was actually underweight, you know, so she was too old and she was underweight. So they didn't want to let her in when she wanted to enlist initially. So she always had this awareness, as you point out, of how her image maybe conflicted with what she was saying, and she played it to the hilt. She always had her Navy uniform on for public appearances and everything. And yeah, it's interesting how much that level of showmanship comes into creating a sort of respectability that allows certain people to speak as experts on topics when certain other people might not be able to speak as an expert on that topic, even though they inhabit a pretty similar role, even though they happen to also be, let's say, a white woman programmer at that point in time.
Say more about that. Who are the other group of women around Grace Hopper whose names we don't know?
Sure. Well, I mean, if you look at some of the women that I was mentioning before as being a little bit peeved at Grace maybe taking a little too much credit, you know, there's Jean Bartik, who helped program some of these early electronic computers right alongside Grace. There's Jean Samet, who, I mean, by rights, she really deserves the title Mother of COBOL. There's Mary Hawes, who, again, was perhaps you could refer to her as a second Mother of COBOL, because she called for the meetings that actually led to the programming language, the common business-oriented programming language that Grace Hopper gets a lot of credit for. And that was, you know, a really, really important language and important thing for computers and computer usability at the time. And Grace Hopper was all about that message of usability. But in being the person to kind of be the standard bearer for that message, she left out a lot of the names of the other women doing the work. And of course, there were a lot of other men doing the work at that time as well. But I think the other women, who are primarily white women programmers, who are really nose to the grindstone on the COBOL project, a lot of them didn't take kindly to the fact that Grace, either intentionally or just by accident, sort of got the credit.
I'm curious how integrated these worlds were, because as you rightly flagged at the beginning, you know, we have this language of hidden figures about Black women mathematicians who are working at NASA, and we have these stories of Grace Hopper and these women in the military. Was there much interaction between white women programmers and Black women programmers, or did they really exist in different worlds?
Well, I think that depends on the part of the country and the time period, of course, because if you're talking about the Jim Crow South or places that were touched by Jim Crow, it's going to be a different story than if you're talking about places in the industrial North, where segregation certainly existed and discrimination existed, I would say, just as badly. But it took a slightly different shape. So you don't really see, I would say, Black and white women programmers working together in the very earliest periods, or in in places that are the South or almost the South. You know, NASA installations were sort of right on the line in that respect. But you do see, by dint of Black women's efforts to achieve and to integrate themselves into, you know, a really racist structure, you do see Black women getting in to these spaces that had previously been reserved for white men and for white women. And so the legacy of the hidden figures that Margot Shetterly so wonderfully talks about in her book is that not only were they doing their jobs in a technical sense, but they were very intentionally paving the way for the Black women who came after them to be able to go further. I mean, some of these hidden figures, they even were in equal opportunity positions in, for instance, NASA, to ensure that, you know, Black women who came after them would actually get a fairer shake, would actually not be discriminated against in the way that they had been.
You know, a lot of times when we talk about women first or women in things like computing, they're often framed as not just women, but feminist. I mean, where does somebody like Grace Hopper fall into that idea?
Yeah, that's so fascinating, right? Because she's almost become the face of not just women in computing, but of a sort of a feminist ethos in computing at this point. And, you know, she went on the record many times saying that she didn't consider herself a feminist. So I do think we have to reckon with that. We have to reckon with the fact that people who we might hold up as somehow feminist heroes, they don't necessarily reflect all of the ideals that we are maybe attributing to them, or they didn't see it that way in their lifetimes.
And why is that? Did she like explicitly reject that term, or did that just language not exist when she was coming up?
Oh, it definitely existed in many other women who worked at the same time in computer programming explicitly said that they were feminists. She rejected that term, I think, because she knew it was unpopular. And part of being somebody who can go out there and proselytize is trying to be popular and trying to be acceptable to everybody. So I think she knew on a certain level she couldn't say that she was a feminist. But I also think that she just didn't really feel that it was a term that applied well to her, because her life was more about being the only woman in the room, not being somebody who was cooperating with the other women in the room and sort of lifting everybody up, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Just so I don't seem like I'm being too negative about Hopper, because I think she was really important. And I think being a good science communicator, it is a really, really important thing. We see today how difficult it is to communicate science concepts and what the stakes around that are. So I think that's really important. And she had a bunch of just really great one-liners. And there's one that I particularly like. She said, "A ship in port is safe, but that is not what ships are made for." And I think that that really sums up so much of what she did and tried to do, and how she maybe plunged ahead and pissed people off sometimes because she was trying to get it done. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Is it true that she also is credited with coining, "It's easier to ask for forgiveness than it is to get permission"?
I think she definitely popularized that. If she's the first person to say that ever, I don't know, but it's definitely attributed to her. She definitely made it very popular.
Yeah, that's a great, I use that saying all the time. And I guess we should also mention one more kind of apocryphal or semi-apocryphal story about her, but she's responsible somewhat, and clear this up for us, but she's somewhat responsible for popularizing the notion of debugging in terms of computers. So tell us about that.
Yeah, that's probably the most famous myth associated with Grace Hopper, that she somehow coined the term computer bug. But really what happened was that the idea of a bug in a machine, in other words, a problem in a machine, this had been something that people had used as a term for a very long time. But while she's working on the Mark I, one day there's a fault that she cannot figure out, and she actually goes into the innards of the machinery and she finds a moth, an actual moth, caught in one of the relays, and that's what's causing the programming fault. So she thinks this is really funny, right? Because it's an actual bug, not a figurative bug. And she plucks out the moth and she gets some tape and she tapes it into the logbook. And she says, this is the first instance of an actual bug ever being found. And if you go to Harvard and you look at the old parts of the Mark I that they have on display in the Science Center, they have a picture of that sheet and logbook. And you can actually see the real moth that she taped to the book.
I love that story because it's gotten garbled in the retelling over the past several decades, but it's actually more charming in its actual verifiable form.
I don't know. I want permission to just walk around thinking that debugging has to do with actual bugs. I like that clean version of that story. All right, let's leave it there. Mar Hicks of Illinois Tech University, and the book is Programmed Inequality. Thank you so much for doing this. This was fascinating.
Thanks for having me.
And Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always.
Thank you, Jody.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of listener-supported, artist-owned shows. It is getting towards the end of the year. If you are in a position to support the things you love this year, you can donate directly to this show through our website, thisdaypod.com. That's also where you can get in touch with any questions or comments about the show, or you can email us, thisdaypod@gmail.com. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
But before that, you also...
I was a college professor.
Yeah, and you worked on the original computer in this country, right?
I was very fortunate. The Navy ordered me to the first big computer in the United States, mm-hmm. Mark I at Harvard.
It's called Mark I at Harvard? Mm-hmm. Now, in those days, the thing was...
51 feet long, 8 feet high, and 8 feet deep.
And that was the pocket model.
That's right. You could put it on a little tiny corner of a chip now.
Yeah. Now, how did you know so much about computers then?
I didn't.
How
I
did
was
you?
The first one.
Yeah.
Radiotopia.